The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business. On December 10, 2010, the Korea Society hosted a panel discussion at the First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta on the missionary experience in Korea. James T. Lenny, former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, led the panel, which included Donald Clark, professor of history at Trinity University, who gave an overview of the history of Christianity in Korea. William Brown, a son and grandson of Christian missionaries to Korea and China, who shared accounts written by missionaries in his family. And the Reverend George Wirth, senior pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta, who suggested that American Christians have much to learn from Korean Presbyterians about church growth, management, and missionary work. The program was part of the Korea Society's Korea Days Regional Outreach Program in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us on what I understand is unusually chilly weather for Atlanta, although coming from New York, it feels just about right at this time of year. I appreciate very much your coming out for this third program in a series we're doing in Atlanta, Korea Days in Atlanta. This program, sponsored by the Korea Society, headquartered in New York, and several partners here in Atlanta, is part of an initiative that we have taken to, quite frankly, get out of New York and bring Korea-related programs to important regional centers all around the United States. When we first started fundraising for this year, and as we thought about where we should begin this program, the idea of Atlanta came up almost immediately. Why Atlanta? Well, there's a large Korean American community here. Atlanta is a major business center. It has active interest in international affairs, very distinguished record of outreach to the rest of the world. In particular, with regard to this exhibit and this program this morning, we were aware that there's a very rich tradition of missionary outreach from Atlanta churches all around the world, and particularly to Korea. So the program over these 2 days, Thursday and Friday, comprises several different events. We had a policy discussion with some leadership of the Atlanta community and Ambassador Han Duck-soo, the Korean ambassador to the United States, yesterday morning at the Commerce Club. And we followed that with a luncheon for business leaders discussing doing business in Korea. Various companies that had experiences of that type. Again, Ambassador Han participated in that. This is the third element in our two-day program. And tonight, I want to encourage you, if you have the time and interest, to take in a Korean film, a very interesting comedy that reveals a lot about Korean society, called Good Morning President, which will be shown 8 o'clock tonight in the White Auditorium at Emory University. But to turn to the program this morning, we are delighted that we were able to bring this really impressive photo exhibit of missionary photographs taken mostly about 175 years ago by American missionaries, many of them from the Atlanta area, in Korea. It shows that Korea, of course, that no longer exists, but it also documents one of the most important connections, historic connections, between people of the United States and the people of Korea, and that is the missionary experience in Korea. This is truly significant in the relationship, and of course one of the most remarkable things about it is that this contact, this meeting of two different peoples and two different cultures planted seeds that have grown beyond anyone's expectations in the last 100 years as Korean churches have developed and become stronger and have themselves moved to send out numerous missionaries to the rest of the world. So it's this experience that we wanted to celebrate and acknowledge and discuss this morning. The photo exhibit is one way of doing it, but our distinguished panel is the complement to the photo exhibits, and I'm delighted that they have been able to join us this morning. We've asked a person that needs no introduction anywhere, Ambassador James Laney, to be our moderator. I had the great pleasure of serving on the staff of Ambassador Laney during my diplomatic career when he was ambassador in Seoul, and so I know how deep his knowledge and appreciation for Korean culture and Korean history is. He's lived, of course, he and his wife Berta have lived in Korea several times, not only as ambassadors, but as teachers, and he was also there early in his career as a American soldier. We have asked him to moderate this panel today and to share with us some of his experiences from many perspectives in dealing with Korea. We're also delighted that Professor Don Clark has joined us today, the co-director of the East Asian Studies program at Trinity University of San Antonio, Texas. Many of the photographs in this exhibit are his, and he has documented many aspects of America's relationship with Korea over the years, written extensively on it, and he is from a missionary family that has extensive experience in Korea. Bill Brown, who's the senior advisor for national intelligence to the National Intelligence Manager for North Korea, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in McLean, Virginia, has a distinguished career also of involvement with Korea. He was born in Korea, raised in Korea, speaks Korean, and is the son of missionaries to Korea and the grandson of missionaries to Korea. So we've asked him to join our panel also. Last but certainly not least, we're very, very pleased that the senior pastor of this church, the First Presbyterian Church, Dr. Wirth, has joined us this morning. This church, of course, is a leading institution in the Atlanta community and is still active around the world in missionary work. And we're hoping that Dr. Wirth will discuss with us today a bit the missionary experience that is still continuing from Atlanta churches around the world. So again, let me thank you very much for coming today to join us. I'll just close by again thanking Dr. Wirth and all of his colleagues here at the First Presbyterian Church for generously offering us, opening their doors to us, and allowing us to have not only the photo exhibit, but this panel in the church today. We're very grateful for that, and we're very grateful for the many other partners and sponsors of our program in Atlanta. So with that, if I may, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Dr. Laney for our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Minton. We appreciate the hospitality and sponsorship of the Korea Society from far away in New York City. And we're glad that you found Southern hospitality to your liking. We feel very proud of the Korean presence here in Atlanta, the growing Korean community, which is very strong and one of the most numerous in the United States. And we look forward to future such programs that you might find profitable to bring here. I want to add my own welcome to all of you and also appreciation to George Wirth, who's a dear friend, for his hospitality in this church and for his leadership, not only in the church, but in the community. This church, over the last 2 decades under his leadership, has not just grown, but it has thrived and flourished with new zeal and power and strength and purpose. And George, we salute you for that and acknowledge your kindness and hospitality here today.
Thank you.
And I must say, I'm delighted with our panel with Don Clark and Bill Brown. I think we ought to simply recognize the fact that the missionary community that went to Korea has deep roots and goes back a long way. Bill Brown has half of the audience from his family today. Three siblings, Mary, Bruce, and George, and his parents, Tommy and Marty. And Bill has a background on both sides of his family, going back at least two generations in Korea. And Don Clark goes back two generations as well. So they speak with great personal knowledge, not necessarily from their own experience, but certainly from what they've gained from their families. And this is promises to be a very rich time. When you stop to think about it, in light of all the tensions that are now mounting on the Korean Peninsula and the headlines that have to do with the free trade agreement and other things, it's hard for us to imagine that before World War II, the principal contact and experience of America and Christianity was through the missionaries, not through military, not through government, not through commerce. They were there, of course, but they were marginal. The real door to the West was through the missionary community in its various dimensions, and that's what we want to explore here today. I want to also acknowledge the presence of my dear wife, who went with me as a missionary. We have experience here through several generations, but Bert and I were actually missionaries for 5 years back from 59 to 64. She's here, and our daughter Mary, who's sitting trying to be inconspicuous in the far back, was born in Korea. Not long after we arrived there in 1959. So I'm delighted to acknowledge them and to say how much it means to see all of you here. And Mark, of course, who was a dear colleague at this embassy in Seoul a good many years ago now, Mark. I hate to say that, but it's true. I just want to mention a couple of things. My first experience with Korea was at the end of 1946, the World War II was over, and I had never been abroad, but courtesy of Uncle Sam, I was sent on a troop ship to Korea. We landed in Incheon in a bitterly cold early January day, and I was soon to be put in the counterintelligence corps there. In the next 15 months, I spent in Korea, recently liberated from the colonial boot of Japan, which had exploited and just done everything imaginable to Korea, trying almost to extirpate the traditional Korean culture, including its language. And despite the fact that there was all this privation, I found the Korean people just dauntless. Their spirit was infectious. There was just such an appeal, and not only in the church, but also in the Korean culture. And while I was principally involved in the nascent political scene at that time, which was trying to take shape for the birth of a new country, I had some marginal experiences with the church. And this was almost before many Korean missionaries, American missionaries, had returned after the war. And that experience literally changed my life. And growing out of that, I went back, and while I finished college with an economics major, I went on to divinity school as a result of that. And then a few years later, now married with three children, returned as a missionary and worked on the campus of Yonsei University, which is the principal private university in Korea. And that was really a pivotal experience for us in many ways. And we saw firsthand at that time, of course, the incredible heritage, the legacy that was the Korean mission in Korea. The educational institutions, the medical institutions, and of course the burgeoning growth of the Christian movement there. We're in a Presbyterian church, and all the panelists except me are Presbyterian, and most of the congregation, most of the group here is probably Presbyterian, not everybody, but some. And I have to admit that the Presbyterians were the most aggressive, the most successful, and the most fractious. And they still are. What I wanted to really point out is that in the post-war, there was the rebuilding, and the missionary movement was very strong through, I guess, the 1970s began to dwindle. But before that, until World War II, when they were had to be repatriated back to the United States, the missionaries in the United States, what went on, the seeds that were planted and the kind of work that went on, prompts me to ask the questions that I hope the panel can address at some point. In that period before World War II, what role did the missionaries play in propelling the Korean Christian Church to such remarkable heights of growth and strength? What makes the church in Korea today so unique? So unique that it probably sends out more missionaries. Now, this is Korea, 1/6 the population of the United States, sends out more missionaries around the world than all the churches in the United States combined. I'm not sure that's, I've heard that said, and it sounds true. What made it possible for Korea to respond as it did, especially when you think of the difference between Korea and Japan and China, where the Christian population in Japan may be less than 1%. I don't know what percentage-wise it is in China. I'd have to ask Mary Bullock, but it probably is not more than 2, is it, would you say, in China, 2%? Yeah, and in Korea, maybe as much as 30%. That's an enormous differential. And so, what? How do we account for that? What are the factors? Not just missionaries, but cultural, political, geographic, all that sort of thing. Why wasn't Christianity seen as a foreign? I mean, not seen principally as foreign, maybe foreign, of course, but not seen as alien as it was in Japan and China. What was it that made that happen? And finally, are there things that we can extrapolate from the experience in Korea as we look around the world today? And so I want to ask each of our panelists, who have 12 minutes, to pull out your watches. I have a little bell. And in addition to their own personal reflections, I hope that they will address at least one or two of the kinds of questions that I think beg for further elucidation and consideration. First would be Don Clark, the redoubtable professor of Korean studies and history and East Asian work at Trinity University in San Antonio. Don?
Okay. That's a great menu of questions to discover. Let me start by just simply saying my perspective on the exhibition and then a little bit about my family background too. I wrote a book published in 2003 called Living Dangerously in Korea, which Jim kindly wrote a blurb about for me. I wanted to reconstruct the community that he talked about of Westerners who had lived before Korea became a household word in the Korean War, because I knew from my mother's family and my father's family, like the Browns, we were back all the way to the turn of the 20th century, 1902 and 1907, living in North Korea, and mainly in Pyongyang, where some of these pictures are taken, that there had been a rich encounter between the West and Korea during this time. That's what this exhibition is about, how it contributed to modernity, and there's inter alia, and if you look carefully, you can see methods of missionary work as well. But I wanted these people not to be forgotten. I knew that the story was being sort of only partly understood in Korea, why these people went, how they lived, what they did, what the circumstances were that they found, how risky the life they had was during that time. And my family encountered all of that, and so did the Browns and the Hoppers and the ancestors of the Browns who are here, Bill. So I wanted that put into some sort of a record, and I worked for 15 years in archives all over the world trying to reconstruct that for Anglicans, Australians, all kinds of people. I turned up all sorts of communities, like white Russian refugee communities, and the consular community, and the business community, digging for gold in the mountains of North Korea, and things like this. So it wasn't just missionaries during this time, but it's something that, you know, in the way the 20th century went, and it's such a tumultuous 100 years, that is easy to forget. I wanted to signify the lives of these people and what they had done. So that was my purpose, and I'm not just flogging the book. I'm just saying that I think that the missionary exhibition here and the things that are written in the catalog carry forth a lot of those messages. For myself, in my life as a professional who is interested in Korea and gets up in the morning and thinks about Korea, and when I go to bed at night and go there all the time, The incredible privilege that I've had since I was a 10-year-old, and my parents took me there a few months after the armistice in 1954. And then even as a child, and I used to think that as a child I would have, the things that I saw were, just children's impressions. But the older I get, the more I realize that the scratches on my mind that were made in those early encounters, even as a 11-year-old or 12-year-old riding my bicycle around the bombed-out streets of Seoul, really set me up to understand something and to have some serious respect for what the Korean people have done. Because what I saw was the amazing thing from 1954 until 2010, what Korea is for all of its foibles and so forth, both North and South, because I've been to the DPRK as well a number of times, and the sadness of sort of seeing what could be happening there but isn't yet. How do people undergo the transition to modern life? How do people undergo the transition from rural life to urban life? How do people undergo the vast material and spiritual transformations that have happened to the Korean people in the last half century and still keep their humanity, their sense of humor, their love of children, their sense of proportion, a certain direction and organized cooperation that goes on? I mean, the strain on a society for something going through that, I mean, as a person who studies in the academy, is an interesting question. I stand in awe of the resilience of the Korean people and the things that they're still likely to be able to achieve, I hope, in the future. Jim asked a bunch of questions, and he only gave us 12 minutes each, so I've burned 6 of them already, and I'm going to just attack a couple of the things he raised, and Bill and George can carry on. The Presbyterians sets some store in the methodology of missions in the first half of the 20th century that they followed. To put it succinctly, it was to go to local leadership and to create opportunities for a local pastorate and for Koreans to set up their own church communities as quickly as possible, independent of missionary financing, missionary leadership dictation, and so forth. It's true that my grandfather was president of the seminary in Pyongyang for a few years after Dr. Moffat in the 1930s, and there was a unified... In those days, Presbyterians, there was one denomination. The last time I looked in the Yearbook of Christianity in Korea, there are 54 different Presbyterian denominations, each with a seminary, and they sort of lost count. But anyhow, in those days there was one, and the pastorate emerged from the seminary in Pyongyang and deployed then across the peninsula into small churches. And in those churches, there were women and families, and there were elders and deacons, and opportunities for leadership and for common people to be somebody. There was a huge emphasis on literacy. The reason for it was to be able to read the Bible, and not to read it in Chinese, but to read it in Korean, Hangul. The idea then that anyone can learn Hangul and that people could become literate, mystique of education, the mystique of literacy that comes with the Confucian society, was something that the Christian church extended through its methods and its emphasis on reading the Bible in Korean to local communities and simple people who may not be able to read very fast, but they'd be able to read. That is incredibly empowering. But then also for women in these communities to say, you can be a deaconess, you can be somebody, you can be a Sunday school teacher, you can go to school, you're not a brute, you're not an animal, you're not a person, you're a human being, and you're someone who God loves. These were things that were moving to people who were suffering under Japanese colonial rule and who had suffered under the social caste system of the Joseon Dynasty monarchy. So the Christian church created environments in little pockets in churches all over Korea that enabled people to feel worthy, worthwhile, and empowered. This at the same time that the Japanese were working on another front to make Koreans feel small, belittled, second rate. Even though they said they were subjects of the emperor, they actually weren't. They didn't have the benefits or the guarantees of the Meiji Constitution at the time that Japanese would have had. Koreans learned this when they went to school in Japan. They were people, but when they came back to Korea, they were subjects. And so the colonial environment, I think, helped to spur a certain alternative sense for Christianity in Christian institutions that a lot of Koreans, intellectuals and others, responded to very well. Korea at the beginning of that century had experienced the collapse of its institutions. Its value system, its monarchical and political and social institutions seemed to have run their course, and Korea had succumbed to foreign domination. It wasn't Western foreign domination. One of the things that I started in my book was that here was a case of colonialism that we don't have to feel guilty about. I mean, the bad guys were Japanese. And so here we were with the West being a kind of an alternative. And these photos bear that out. The science education, the streak of photos down there from Severance Union Medical College showing science education, the little sodalities and kindergartens that were run by the Catholic sisters, Marinoles and others, in North Korea especially. And then the number of groupings of women around here who are being empowered, the Yeochandosa, the women, the Bible women, the women who had some serious prestige in their communities. Men couldn't do this, and foreigners could never have done it. It was done through local leadership, so they were astute enough to train local leadership. I think that's my 12 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Brown.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for inviting me. I was looking at these great pictures here, and the very first one, right over here behind my sister, Mary, is one from Yongbyon, North Korea.
Yes, oh yes, right.
Which is, of course, my day job is looking very closely at Yongbyon. That's the site of the centrifuge plant that the North Koreans just revealed. Now, if that had been a Southern Presbyterian mission, I'm sure they would not have a centrifuge plant there. I believe it
you
was.
You never know.
I'm pretty sure it was a Methodist.
It's a Methodist station, yeah.
What I thought I'd do is just give a little bit of a story. It's complicated because my mother's parents, my maternal grandparents, were missionaries in Mokpo from 1920 to 19, right after the Korean War. But my father's side parents, my father's parents, my grandparents, my paternal grandparents were missionaries in China. And in August, a bunch of us followed the path that he took, my grandfather Brown took, on his very first trip to Asia. So in August 13th, 1910, He landed in Yokohama, August 13, 2010. I landed in Yokohama. And then I followed this diary that he produced exactly 100 years ago, printed it up in Shanghai and published it. So I followed this itinerary for about 3 weeks through Japan, through Korea, and then through China, where the rest of them, my siblings, joined me. I thought I would read just a few excerpts from this diary because it's intriguing to me that you go all the way back to 1910. This is sort of the second wave of missionaries that are getting to Korea. Already, most of what we think of Korean church is in place, I think. I think it's kind of astonishing. It, in a lot of ways, it sort of diminishes the role of the missionary, but supports the role of the indigenous Korean church. Let me just read you a few things here, at the risk of using up my 12 minutes. The voyage across the Straits of Tsushima was made in 11 hours. It took me 12 hours. Talks about in Busan, lands in Busan, a big new school. An American has given $3,500 for a new school in Busan, a new medical college in Seoul. It's probably Severance College starting up. Beautiful view of the harbor. Then he goes over to, gets on a little boat and goes over to Mokpo, where, you know, 10 years later, my other grandparents, it's just very confusing. The common denominator here is the denomination. They're all Southern Presbyterian. So he's going to Southern Presbyterian mission stations throughout this area. Mokpo, I won't read. My mother's from Mokpo, so I won't read. He's not real happy with Mokpo. But then he goes to Gwangju, where all of us, where I grew up, where all of us lived for many years. Gwangju, August 27th, the annual meeting of the Korean mission in session. 40 missionaries in attendance. They are very enthusiastic and thankful over the Korean Special Equipment Fund, but are wrestling over the problems of which buildings to erect first. See, they're funded very strongly by churches back here, probably even this church, the Central Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. All over the South, there's this big wave of giving for these to support these missionaries. It's not just the missionaries. It's the people behind them sending lots of money, $3,500 for this. This school. August 28th, attended my first Korean service. It's moving to hear these poor people just out of, quote, heathenism, sing with feeling our familiar tunes. About 200 people were present, seated on the floor, always the women on one side, the men on the other, and the preacher with a curtain in between. Preaching to both sides of it, because women and men are not allowed to be mixed. Let's see, he gives a little statistics. This is in the Honam area, Chalanamdo, Chalapukto. 2,100 baptisms in that year. That's 1910. Already there are 2,100 baptisms just in Honam. That's kind of an average year he's talking about. And then he goes to Chunju, rides a horse, you know. It's just amazing. 70 miles on Japanese horses. A party of four en route to Chunju. Telegraph wires always in sight. The music of water running through the rice fields always in our ears. Gold miners at work with their primitive placer mines. I never knew there was gold in Honam. Daddy never told us that. A night spent in a village Christian school, evangelists and elders, a grateful people, anxious to see the missionaries, splendid weather, blah, 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 blah. Chunju, he talks about the new hospital there. They just got funding for a big new hospital. It's the Yesu Pyongyang. Then he goes to Kunsan, 30 miles ride on Dr. Patterson's good horse over an excellent Japanese road. Brought me to Kunsan. Now, Kunsan is actually where my mother was born. That station was closed after World War II. But I visited it. It's really quite interesting. big churches all over. Every place that we would go that I visited, in Korea, but actually even in Japan and certainly in China, the institutions that the missionaries started are very present. Of course, the people are all gone. Everybody's dead 100 years later. But the churches are there everywhere. The schools are booming. And in every place, there's a big modern hospital. Often in several places, they're being expanded greatly. This is all throughout Korea, Japan, and China, every place that I went. So the institution building is very important for the missionaries. But it's not just that. Then he goes to Seoul, attends a conference of Korean missionaries, 130 missionaries present in Seoul for this annual meeting. He says the best demonstration of Christian unity in the world in Seoul, this combined a lot of different missions working there. Then he goes to Pyongyang, 150 miles by rail. Now, my boss wouldn't let me go to Pyongyang. A fine, well-ballasted road. And he always talks about the railroads. I suppose this is one of the most famous mission stations in the world. Every Sunday morning when the church bells ring, 4,000 people out of a population of 40,000 gather for worship in six large churches. The most sacred spot I have stood upon in Korea, this is in Pyongyang, was one of those churches in which the great revival first got way 3 years ago. This is 1907 when your grandparents were there. Now, let me just read you one thing about this revival. This is from a little booklet my dad produced about 10 years ago. I found it in my study. He tries to answer most of your questions. I think he does a pretty good job with it. Let me read you this one part. Well, because I have a couple of additions. This is talking about this revival. It seems to have all begun in the well-attended men's winter Bible class in Pyongyang in 1907. At the end of one service, people began to pray all at once together. The Reverend W.N. Now, this is not sounding very Presbyterian. The Reverend W.N. Blair describes what happens next. Then began a meeting the likes of which I had never seen before, nor wish to see again, unless in God's sight it is absolutely necessary. Every sin a human being can commit was publicly confessed that night. Pale and trembling with emotion, in agony of mind and body, guilty souls, everything else is forgotten. Now, from this sort of Pentecostal meeting, he goes on and on, but I'll just say, under the impetus of this Pyongyang Pentecost, which continued in the seminary and other institutions, the revival movement gained momentum, swept over the whole Korean church, and left an indelible stamp on its character even to today. So here's the indigenous church people, irrespective of the missionaries, are starting to expand like crazy. The church, Christians then, the next, Christian population doubles every 10 years for the next, probably even up to the modern times. So it starts from a small base, but it's doubling even in 1910. 1920s was a bad year. That's when the Japanese took over. They did not double that decade. Every other decade, the Christian population doubled. And it's, I think, mostly the impetus of the indigenous church. Let me just run down quickly what my dad's answers your question of why the Christian church has grown so fast. He says and he's comparing it to China, because he, of course, grew up in China, and he's looking at the Chinese. What in 1985 looked like a failure in China. The thing is, looking at China today, it's not a failure at all. You see enormous growth in the Christian church in China. One, no gunboats. It's the lack of American gunboats, which were, of course, in China. In other words, it wasn't a nationalistic U.S. government kind of activity. Secondly, it was this Navius plan that you're talking about. Even the Chinese use it now, the three-self movement in China. Self-support, self-government, self-propagation. if you think about it, this is very Reform, very Protestant, very Presbyterian, very Calvinist way of growth, right? Individual-oriented, self, everything focused on the individual, but in a community. And then the system they worked with, my uncle, my grandfather, my uncle, and my dad start off being itinerant preachers, traveling around 50 churches a year, 100 churches a year. They're just visiting, doing the sacraments, but the churches themselves are dependent on the lay leaders. So very quickly, my dad is focused on building a Bible school that becomes a seminary. But with his self-government, pretty soon, late 1970s, Daddy moves away, and the seminary becomes wholly run by Koreans. Today, visited at that Honam Seminary in Gwangju. I bet you it's bigger than any Presbyterian seminary in America. Huge. All driven by itself. All driven by Koreans. Third, the way the denominations all work together in Korea. Four, a conscious strategy focus that they developed. Everything is very organized and conscious. They have these meetings and they decide a strategy and they do it. Strategy, I think, is created in around 1905. They're going to target the bottom up. They had it with the Confucius men. They can't deal with the Confucius men, the hierarchy. The Methodists did well with Sigmund Rhee, but other than that, the Presbyterians work bottom up, focusing on the poor people, women, and children. Focus is hugely on women education, Bible leaders. Not, and then fifth, no, they're not representatives of a colonial power. This again, of course, in China, you know, there's Japan. I forgot to say, when my grandfather first, the day he went to from Shimonoseki to Busan on August 10th, he carried with him the first newspaper that declared Japan's annexation. All the terms of that. He carried it with him, the first one to Korea. Sort of, and then his whole career, his career in China, of course, is wrapped up in the Japanese. And you have a sort of good and bad relationship with the Japanese. It's not all bad. Certainly, the Japanese brought order. It built the trains. It modernized Korea in a huge way. But there's this huge downside of the Japanese colonial trying to, especially in Korea, trying to run, take over the country. In China, there's much more fighting. It's much more, hugely more violent in China. It's not really so violent in Korea. I think a lot of Koreans maybe exaggerate the violence a little bit. Let me just add two things. I'm an economist, so I look at Daddy's work, and I think two more things he left out. If you look at the Reform traditions beginning in Switzerland, all throughout Western Europe, America, Canada, and Australia, anywhere there's a strong Reformed church, you have strong capitalism. And to me, this sentiment, and I think of it as a very, in a very positive way, where capitalism is, it's so dependent on individual responsibility. It's not the big family that you see in the Latin world or in the Catholic world. It's so pinpointed on the individual. And Korea manages to, you know, sort of a community-oriented country manages to grapple with that individualism of Protestantism, and it works like magic in terms of economic development. The richest countries today almost always have this Reformed tradition. Korea's economic growth, I think, is hugely a result of this Reformed individual-oriented tradition. Second thing, and a lot of y'all will cringe at this, Daddy certainly cringes at this, I argue it's all about competition. And the 57 denominations that you talk about, I say, wonderful. Because what, you know, like, we're all driven by competition. If you look at Korean churches, you know, there's one. Yeah, I look from my old house in Gwangju out over the, and I can see our old Yongnim church, but there's another one and another one and another one and another one, and they don't talk to each other. I mean, they are visceral.
I think St. Paul has something to say about it.
But this competition has I think, you know, as with companies, it's caused efficiency and push to growth. You know, bad things come from it, sure, but it's a fact of life. And in Korea's case, I think it's worked very well. That's probably my 12 minutes.
Before my brief reflections, because I know the least about Korea of the panelists sitting here at the table, again, I want to welcome everyone here. A special thanks to Dr. Laney, my dear friend, for really envisioning this gathering, and then Ambassador Mitten and Steve Norper called, and we were able then to develop this wonderful exhibition of these striking photographs that tell an amazing story. I want you to know in this room we have members of our staff who have worked on this event. Craig Goodrich, just put your hand up so everybody knows Craig. We're grateful other members of the staff are here too. Hardy Kim, who is an associate pastor here for Church Growth, and Peg McCurdy in the back row. And we have some of our officers officially representing the session here. And they are Cindy Candler, if you'll put your hand up, former chair of the Mission Council, Larry Galindo in the back, who grew up in Cuba, and Daryl Payne as well. And we're glad to host this gathering. The Presbytery of Greater Atlanta is the largest presbytery in the Presbyterian denomination that we belong to. Some folks say we're denser here than anywhere else. And I think there's probably some truth to that. But compared to Korea, even our five different Presbyterian families that exist here in the United States, we are vastly smaller in number. And the missionary movement of the late 19th and early 20th century has, the child greatly outgrew the parent. And now, actually, the parent, the Korean churches, are sending missionaries to us. Our denomination in America, like the Protestant denominations, is declining. We need missionaries to come and talk to us about church growth and about the way the Spirit moves in powerful dimensions. And the Korean church, we have a lot to learn from all of you who are part of that Korean church. I want to read something to you from a sermon. Oh, by the way, I interviewed the pastor of what I was told is the largest Presbyterian church in the world in Seoul. I think it's called Anak
Yeonnam.
And the pastor who was there was a powerful man, and we have a broadcast ministry here, television and radio, and so we got hooked up, and I interviewed him about 10 years ago. I try to imagine what a 100,000-member church would be like. You know, when you add in all the children and teenagers here, we're about 3,000 here. The biggest Presbyterian church in our denomination is Peachtree. They're 9,000. I can't imagine 100,000 in one congregation, but the pastor said small groups is the key. Strong worship, scripture and prayer, small groups. And once again, we have a great deal to learn from the Korean church in that regard. Sam Moffitt and Eileen are good, close friends of mine. They are in Princeton. He is retired now. But as many of you know, the Moffitt and Underwood families have spent lifetimes in Korea in the mission movement, helping to establish churches and schools and medical centers. In 1983, Sam Moffitt preached at a conference, a convention of Presbyterians, and we gathered in Dallas, Texas, and it was called the Congress on Renewal. Craig Goodrich's father-in-law, rest his soul, Louis, was there to preach to us as well, Louis Evans. Sam Moffitt's sermon, with all respect to Louis Evans, this was the sermon I remembered. And it's entitled, Where's the Power? Power for Mission Renewal. I want to quote three paragraphs, and then I think we want to open it up for everybody to get involved in the congregation, in the conversation. That's how it began in Korea about 100 years ago. Remember, this is 1983. So you add 27 years. The Korean church is now celebrating 100 years of Protestant Christianity. He goes on to say, there was power. Power in the Spirit. Power for witness. Power came to Korea in the Great Revival, 1904 to 1908. And what happened after the power came? The Presbyterians organized a presbytery. If you think that's anticlimax, then you're trying to tell the Holy Spirit how to work in ways that the Spirit doesn't always work. The Spirit works when, where, and how the Spirit pleases. And perhaps some of the power of the Presbyterians in Korea is exactly that. Together with the revival, they organized a presbytery. Listen to John R. Mott, not only a great evangelist, but a great organizer. He said, pray as if there was no such thing as organization, but then organize as if there was no such thing as prayer. And the Koreans did both. They prayed and they got organized. And the power came. They took that power, organized the presbytery, used the presbytery to send out their first missionaries. They had just organized, and within the first year, they talked about missionaries. Those first seven ordained Korean ministers, ordained at that first meeting of the first Korean presbytery, they decided at the first meeting, we're about to become the first ministers of this church. They looked around at each other and said, a real church needs to have more than ministers. One of us has to be a missionary. A real church has missionaries. So they looked hard at one of the seven people in the room, and they said to him, didn't you stone the first missionary you ever saw? He hung his head and said, yes. All right, they said, you're going to be our first missionary. And they took him in to the presbytery, whose moderator happened to be the man he stoned, Sam Moffat said, my own father. And that man, he stoned, ordained him. My father ordained him as the first Korean missionary. We have a lot to learn from the Korean church. What we know about Korea and the revival that still exists is that there's power there. And we in the mainline Protestant denominations, especially in North America, we need to tap into that power more directly. Almost at the same time as the late 18th and 19th century in Korea, in the Church of Scotland, they went into East Africa, parallel to this movement. And some of us in this room have been to East Africa many times, to Kenya, where we have one of our five mission partnerships. We're fortunate to be helping to build a university there in Kikuyu, north of Nairobi, and a medical school. The Presbyterians built the church, the school, and then the hospital, just like Korea. And I think that is something unique to Presbyterian mission, to Methodist mission, Baptist mission. We went in and realized you're not only going to preach and teach the gospel, you've got to establish a deep foundation. Last thing I'll say is that now we have partnerships, this church does, in five places, in Kenya, in Brazil, in Jamaica, in Haiti, and in Honduras. And we now call them partnerships. And that has become what I think all of us know as the model. We're no longer the ones who are sending and helping to establish. The indigent populations there now, long ago, have taken over all the institutions. We're fortunate now to be their partners and to learn from them how to grow the church and share the gospel and reach out and help those people who are poor and who are disabled in any way. And those partnerships are flourishing. And that is true with the church in Korea.
If thank all of you very much, Don and Bill and George. I feel somehow as a Methodist that we've been overshadowed here.
Well, I did mention Sigmund Ray. We can't forget.
I feel an obligation to point out that when the Underwoods arrived in 1885, there was also a Methodist on board named Appenzeller, and that Mary Scranton the next year, and this is really important, started the first girls' school in 1886. She brought some young girls to her home and began teaching them, and they soon learned how to read and write in Hanku, and of course for them to study the Bible. And out of that grew what is now the largest women's university in the world, IHWA, which is a great institution there. And by the way, it's a Methodist institution. I don't think that we can overstate the importance of women's empowerment in the role of the church in Korea, beginning with education and going through the whole gamut. Bible women, which Don mentioned earlier, the sense of being somebody and having a role and a responsibility and reaching out and sharing that in ways that would never have happened or much belatedly if it had been left simply to men and certainly to foreigners. So that was part of the indigenous role that we see. The other thing I want to mention and emphasize is I think we cannot overstate how important the church was during the Japanese colonial occupation. Not because of the missionaries, but because the church was one of the few things other than the family that remained truly Korean. As the occupation went on, the Japanese tried to extirpate even the Korean language. In outside contacts, the families had to take on Japanese names. But it at home and in the sanctuary of the church, they were able to be truly Korean. And I think in that regard, Koreans, even those who were non-Christians and never converted, saw the church as something that was no longer alien or foreign, but it was theirs. And they made it theirs. And this was largely, you know, independent of the missionaries. I think in all of this, we're saying that in the early days of the church, the genius of the Korean church was the way in which the indigenous government and leadership took over and ran the church. That was, from the beginning, the plan, but it really worked in Korea in a most amazing way. Now we'll turn this discussion over to any questions or any questions from among the panelists to each other. But since no one's raising, yes, Don, do you have a question?
I'd just like to make a point about the catalog of this exhibition. Like any good exhibition catalog, it contains a number of articles on the subject. And the content of those articles is germane to what we've been saying. So very briefly, in addition to a historical article by me about the whole missionary effort, there is one that we commissioned by Chang-uk Byun, a colleague in Seoul, on the Korean receiving. It was hard to find in English texts that tell us really significant stuff about how Koreans took the gospel message, how they received it, and things from the Korean point of view. He was commissioned to do that. Did a very nice job. The other one is an article. Another one is an article by Haewol Che, now of the Australian National University, on the response of women and the importance of women, which Dr. Laney just mentioned. And then the last one is an interview done at the Korea Society with Don Baker of the University of British Columbia, who is a premier historian of Korean Protestant and Catholic religion, about how Koreans intuit spirituality, how they understand God in their tradition, and how the bringing of Christianity to Korea flowed together with things that are indigenous and Korean tradition. Now, understanding that helps us answer the original question that Dr. Laney asked.
All right, yes.
My name is Daryl Payne. I'm stationed in Hamilton in the 1980s. And I was wondering if you could tell us what's happened to the churches in North Korea under all these years of dictatorship. Is there any activity at all? And did the South Korean churches have a plan or something that, as far as the question goes?
Could everyone hear the question?
Good.
What happened to the churches in North Korea?
Yeah, well, I have, Bill may have an answer, but I've attended Easter services twice at the Chilgol Church in Pyongyang where, different visits, where Kim Il-sung is associated. He built this chapel ostensibly in memory of his mother, who was a Presbyterian deaconess and used to lead him by the hand to Sunday school until he, you know, refused to go anymore, they say. And this service is a very moving experience. It has a pastor. The pastor doesn't wear the button. And the people who are Pyongyang residents who attend that church, which is not very many, the congregation is largely visitors. But they have a beautiful choir, and the choir sings movingly in things that I remember, the hymn, Who is Jesus, sung to the tune of Go Tell Aunt Rhody. And I once heard them sing in Korean the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is a Korean hymn. I mean, there's a certain surreal experience to this. There are two Protestant churches and one Catholic church in Pyongyang, and then a Chundokyo church. I mean, the state owns the property. The state licenses the pastor. The state watches this, and people who are authentically in it do not wear the button, do not have, you know, the privileges of the society. I mean, they can do that, but they're dissenters, and it's not very many. Now, that's all that I can see on the surface when I visit North Korea with a Christian group. There may be more underground, but, you know, we can't say, could you take us underground and show us all the underground Christians?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because it's easy to be sort of kind of romantic about all of this, look back at all the good things that have happened. I myself would be relatively critical with what's happened in North Korea. And I'm afraid Christianity may play part of a role in that. When the Soviets took over Pyongyang, they pretty much co-opted Pyongyang was probably the most Christianized city in Asia outside of Manila, which of course is a Catholic city. Outside of Manila, Pyongyang had probably more Christians by then. My understanding is the Russians come in, the Soviets come in, and basically co-opt the Christians and take over the city and use that to sort of, in the sort of communitarian way of Christianity, use that to help them, if you think about it, take this very difficult role of taking over North Korea. Then with the, as soon as the communists themselves took over, they abolished any tolerance of religion. The Christians fled in mass, probably over a million. If you wonder why there's so many Christians in Pyongyang, in Seoul, Yongnak Presbyterian Church, it's supposed to basically a transplant from Pyongyang. Probably like a million people fled North Korea with the onslaught of these communists who had no tolerance for religion. The Korean War even more came over. So a huge number of the Christians in North Korea came down to Seoul. They didn't go much further. Many of them came here to America. So Korean Americans are unusually the higher proportion originally from North Korea than you might expect, because that once you've moved, you keep moving. Looking at today, though, I'm always cautious because, you know, looking at China in the 70s when I was, everybody thought Christianity mm-hmm. was pretty much dead mm-hmm. in China. Now you look back there now and I just saw this huge church, you know, 3,000 members. Obviously, it wasn't dead. It was just dormant or just not visible. So you wonder what's not visible. Problem is, as hard as we look, it's not there. I mean, these two, I would say, silly little churches. No church is silly, but they're fronts for the communist government. Yeah. They're totally front organizations. I don't think I would even want to go to them. because the they generate the sort of feeling for, oh, everything's fine in North Korea. Everything is not fine in North Korea. North Korea is just such an incredibly hostile place for its own people that I don't, I think the sort of sometimes the Christian tolerance to North Korea is helping actually maintain that regime. I mean, that's just my perspective, but I do look at North Korea every day, and there's not much good things that I see about it.
Are there any statistics about the leadership migration from the North Korean church during those years? I mean, would it be your guess that a high proportion of the church leadership left?
Oh, I would think virtually all of it left, or were I don't know. You might.
This is a brutal story in the history of the Korean church, and it's sort of informally documented in a novel by Richard Kim called The Martyred. If you were a Christian in North Korea between 1945 and 1950, you could worship and do that, and you could go to these grand churches that were built, but if you weren't a party member, I mean, you weren't going to get a job as a teacher or be part of the structure or something like that. Now, when those people welcomed the UN forces and the ROC, First Marine Division, coming back to North Korea in 1950, they exposed themselves and became, and in the aftermath of that, in the Chinese counter-invasion, when people were caught, there was a considerable amount of tragic and awful apostasy on the part of even pastors from North Korea who begged for their lives and were put to death anyway. And so in the awful history of the Korean church during that time and the disruption in North Korea, there's tragedy beyond imagining. Yes, and the lucky ones came south, but things changed, and it was worth your life to be identified as a Christian or to have be known as someone who came out and welcomed the liberation of Pyongyang. You know, that was their crime in the system. And so, yeah, Bill is right. These churches are fronts. But what to make of it? You just don't know.
Question over here.
I just want to add to that comment, this observation, that the flight to the south from the north, where there was such a concentration of Christians, began occurring almost immediately after liberation in 1945, mm-hmm. and it picked up all before the Korean War. So for more than 4 years, you had a huge influx of refugees from the north, many of whom were Christians. So the influx of that meant had a lot of leadership, including Han Kyung-jik, the pastor of the church that George mentioned a while ago, this huge Presbyterian church in Seoul. I'm not sure it's the biggest now, but it is very large. There may be a Methodist church bigger.
We have received the point, Dr. Lady.
And Mary?
My dad wants to ask best two comments.
Certainly, the points that have been made are, I think, a valid leadership education. There's two things that prosperity needs to keep in mind, and that is, one of them, Christianity entered Korea at the time when they were being colonized by Japan. It was an Asian power. Not another Western power, but it was an Asian power, and that the Christianity aligned itself with the freedom people, and that was a second record. Christianity, the Christian missionaries, adopted a plan that was a distinctive plan, and the whole, both Methodists and Presbyterians adopted the plan and made it work. What was the plan? The plan was named for John L. Nevius. Nevius was a missionary, a Presbyterian, in North China. And he adopted a plan in which the plan was that they would be, they would, said everybody in the nation adopted it, and it worked. What was the plan? The plan was very similar to what later on came across as the Three Cells movement in North China. Three Cells was the three cell self-government, adopting the plan and making it work as quick as possible. Quick as possible. They would transfer authority from the local church to that of the elder. That was the plan in which it was roundly used that's called the Navy's plan. The Navy's plan, in which it, for the formative years of the Presbyterian missionaries there, it worked in a very wonderful way.
Amen.
That was Dr. Tommy Brown, who spent many years in Korea, who comes from this long line, whose son is on the panel with us here, Bill. Bill had mentioned earlier that competition played a big role in the growth of the Protestant church. I would say that animosity has also had a hand in it. I think particularly of animosity between the Koreans and the Japanese. I was at a conference in the early 60s, was a student conference, actually, of East Asia from countries all around. And I remember distinctly a person from Japan getting up and excoriating the West and the colonialism of the West and how Christianity had that terrible burden. And as soon as this young man sat down, a Korean got up and he said, I hear this from our Japanese friend, but the only colonial power that we knew was not from the West, it was from our neighbor Japan. And they got a huge round of applause because, of course, most of Asia had been colonized but Japan. And it was that role of the independence of Korea and the independence of the church, I think, that confluence that made such a difference or helped add to the strength of the identity of the church with Korea, made it theirs. Other questions? Yes.
I'm curious, Angie, to know, I've visited the Anglican Cathedral a couple of times in Seoul, and I know there is a Korean church there attached to it, but there aren't very many Anglicans in Korea, and there's no Korean Episcopal church that I've ever heard of. Why were the Anglicans so unsuccessful? The story I heard when I was at the cathedral once was that they were collaborators with the Japanese, and I have no idea if that's true, and just wonder if any of you have a thought on that issue.
There is a denomination that corresponds, the Episcopalian denomination. It's not Anglican, but it's called Sungonghwa, and it is a Korean Anglican church, and it has congregations around, but that's its headquarters, that's its home church. The church was sort of, in a Romish way, subject to missionary authority much longer than the denominations we're talking about, which tried as hard as they could, as fast as they could, to shift over to local community leadership in churches. So both the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, over time, labored under a handicap of foreign, sort of, in this case, British. I mean, they had archbishops and some of the most, Archbishop Trollope and other various really important key people who are associated with that church, that beautiful church in Seoul. But the thing that you're talking about as far as the collaboration is that in the 1930s, when the Japanese imposed upon all Koreans the political obligation of showing respect to the emperor by worshiping at Shinto shrines. Different Protestant churches, different churches broke out differently. The Japanese said, this is just a civic right. You just do it like saluting the flag, like pledging allegiance. And other people were saying, no, you know, you're worshiping deities, you're engaging in the Shinto religion. And so, I mean, there's been a lot of parsing about state Shinto and the shrine Shinto. But here's the point. The Anglicans, the Catholics, and to some extent the Methodists, though not everyone, said this is a political thing, it's the law of the land. And there were a number of Presbyterian missionaries who also said that's the situation. This tore the church apart because the Presbyterian General Assembly took a vote. The vote was forced with police pressure in the room about whether or not a Christian could participate in these patriotic rites. Some of the churches just went along by their leadership, and the Anglicans went along with their leadership. So then after the war, when it's all over, there's a lot of chickens that come home to roost on this particular point. You collaborated. We went to prison. And those stakes and those costs that a lot of Christians suffered to be steadfast created immense tension in all denominations, but the Anglicans bear that. That's, I think, what you're referring to.
Let me make one other point on that, because I don't think it's quite well understood in America. I think it's well understood in Korea. But if you think of all the Western colonization and the expansion of Western thought and economy in the 17th, 18th centuries, the Europeans never really got to Korea. They touched it barely, the Dutch a little bit. China, of course, is a pretty big barrier. Japan itself was a barrier, and not many ships would go up past Japan. That's a long way. So by the 1880s or so, Americans start crossing the Pacific. The gold rush, 49 gold rush, creates this huge trade across the Pacific, and Americans start getting there. I'm not a historian, but I'm thinking that America's relationship with Korea, Americans more than any other sort of civilized part of the world, opened Korea much more than the Europeans are used to doing everywhere else in the world. So the U.S.-Korean relationship is very unique in that respect. Secondly, a little story. I was listening to my grandmother one time, watching television, early 70s, and all these demonstrations going on in Korea. And my grandmother, who spent, 30, 40 years in Korea, was looking at it and she says, Billy, after all these years in Korea, I still can't understand Koreans. What are they demonstrating about? And then I remarked, I said, well, grandmother, why did you go to Korea? And she said, well, it's the ends of the earth. See, where were they? They were in Rock Hill, South Carolina in 1915, 1920. If you think about going to, if you're going to the farthest place in the world, it's not anymore. Now, airplanes and all. In those days, Korea would have been, in fact, grandmother one time comes back to Virginia by way of Moscow and France. They get on the train in Mokpo, get off in France, and take the easy Atlantic trip to Norfolk. In that sense, America and Korea are really, as civilized places, really about as far different as you can get. So this incredible difference in civilization, and yet it's linked really strongly in the beginning with these missionaries, but actually beginning with traders in the late 1800s. And so you get this very unique link between America and Korea that I don't think you find anywhere. I mean, I'm obviously biased Korea side, but I don't think you find this sort of unique relationship anywhere else. So you get a lot of American influence in Korea. There's an American gold mining company in North Korea, pretty big one in 1910 or 1920. Mm-hmm. Trade, our first trade is we're exporting ginseng to Korea, Virginia, Appalachian, first ships. A lot of trade, even in the late 1800s.
I have a question. I think it's
have a question probably for Don, and that is about where was the opposition to missionaries, and particularly in the 19th century, prior to the colonization of Japan. In the 19th century is when you had, certainly in China, all the opposition.
Right.
And it was pretty structured opposition. How was that paralleled in Korea? How was it different?
There was I think we're up here now.
Did everybody hear the question?
The question is about where was the opposition that corresponds to in the 1880s and 90s in China. There was a considerable public reaction in locations and pockets, especially Shandong, against American missionaries, and there were deaths. In Korea, there was never an opposition of that level, but certainly among intellectuals in Korea, there was a ferocious opposition to the intrusion, largely reflecting, I think, conservative Confucian ideas that had come over from China. This is why we asked Chang Ukbyun to write that article in the catalog, because he went after that particular topic, trying to fight off Western, this pollution, this spiritual pollution, but then also among other people who said, well, there's something to it, and so that you can maybe maintain Eastern ethics and Western ideas, and somehow they can be made compatible, which is a formula they use in Japan and China as well. So, I don't want to just duck it by saying, well, read the article, but that's a terribly important. Now there was other sort of more plebeian stuff that corresponds to like the Tientsin massacre or whatever. There were rumors that came over. I think they must have generated from China because they're so sort of parallel. But they have to do with American missionaries. They start a little orphanage. They take the babies. They take out their eyes. They grind them up into whatever the potions are that Westerners use for medicine, and that's what they're dispensing in the hospital and selling. Or they're paying people to go kidnap babies and turn them into the orphanage's orphans so they can use their eyes for. So that stuff. And so there's an attack on the orphanage or something that happened a few times in Korea. They're called baby riots. But there was nothing like the organized sense of disruption that Westerners created in places like Shandong that led to violent outbreaks on that scale. Things changed too fast in Korea, and it started too late. Yeah.
But I would add to that, though, earlier, especially French Catholic missionaries, did go to Korea and ran into much more organized resistance, and were
right. The Christianity has more than 200 years. The first 100 years of this tragic century of massacre and right. I don't want to leave out that and Catholics would certainly be outraged to hear me. It's a sort of skip the 100 years of the persecution of 1866. That was that's like even living memory almost. So. But we're talking about the Protestant century after 1884.
Well, one of the things that all of us are aware of is that China was being forcibly opened to American commercial interests, and the Boxer Rebellion was one of the results. Mm-hmm. And many of the missionaries fled to Korea at that time.
Right.
And were over there for a few years until it was safe to go back. But at the same time that we were having the Boxer Rebellion, Alice Roosevelt, the daughter of the president, visited Korea. One of the prized pictures in the embassy house, the ambassador's house in Seoul, is of Alice Roosevelt with a huge hat and a voluminous skirt, standing with all of the Marines and the ambassador in Seoul in 1900, I think, something like that. So you have right there a difference. Here we are visiting with the president's daughter, and there's a sense of friendship. And in China, we have gunboats going up the Yangtze River. And that, that speaks worlds as to how it's received. And I think that once they got over the sense of the hermit kingdom and being invaded simply by an alien outside power, I think that Korea was, of course there was resistance and there was opposition, but basically it never came to that kind of organized resistance and rejection. I think our time is about up, and I want to thank our panel Don, Bill, and George, and all of you for your participation and your attendance. Thank George again for his hospitality here in the church. It is a Presbyterian church. You've done well, George. You got your word in. And we want to thank Mark Minton, Ambassador Minton, the president of the Korea Society, for hosting this and for the presence here for these 2 days that's been so successful, bringing Korea to the attention of the Atlanta community. Thank you very much.
Dr. Zaney. Before Mark closes us, this has been our great honor to host this gathering. And it's been wonderful to get to know Ambassador Minton and also Steve Norper and now these two distinguished panelists. We have a presentation to make, and I'm going to ask Craig Goodrich to come forward with me to Ambassador Minton. And this is our history book, not quite all the way back to the ancient history of Korea, but to the history of Atlanta, 1848, when our church was founded. Mrs. Candler was the chair of the anniversary, and during her time and our time here, we published this book, A Church on Peachtree. We've inscribed it, December 10, to Ambassador Minton, with gratitude for our collaboration with the Korea Society. God be with you all. Faithfully, Craig Goodrich and George Wirth. And I'm going to ask Craig to give this to the ambassador.
This is the second to last copy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Laney, this is for you. Sam Moffat's sermon, Where's the Power? We want you to have that. And Steve, I have one last thing for you. Where is Steve? Did he leave the room? Is he still here? This is a cartoon to give to Steve Norper when he comes back in the room. It's a Gary Larson cartoon. It's the original manger scene, three wise men that are there, an angel inside, but one wise man slinking away into the darkness. And the cartoon says, unbeknownst to most theologians, there was a fourth wise man who was turned away for bringing a fruitcake. We're glad that all of you came. No one was turned away, and we're looking forward to the next event.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wirth, General Laney, Don, Bill. I just want to share one last piece of information. Again, thank the First Presbyterian, Dr. Wirth, and your colleagues for hosting this. I can't remember a richer discussion in any of our programs reflecting on Korean history, American history, and one almost feels one has to revise the historical record to reflect the profound effect that the missionary movement has had on Korea and the United States and the relationship between the two countries. We're a small group today of people who have a special interest in this subject, but I wanted to close by telling you that all of our programs are recorded, and this was recorded for a podcast. For those of you that don't know, a podcast is either an audio or audiovisual program that can be put on your website. In our case, KoreaSociety.org. We have many of our programs up there already, and this program will go up as a podcast. This is an innovation that we have brought to the Korea Society programming in the last year, and the response has been enormous. Some of our podcasts get thousands and thousands of hits. On some days, we've had more hits than the United Nations podcast or the Council on Foreign Relations. I want you just to know that this extremely informative and rich discussion is not ending in this room today, but will, in fact, be available to thousands of people, and I'm sure it will be listened to by thousands of people in the months to come. So thank you again to our panelists, the First Presbyterian Church, and all of you for joining us today. Thank you.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.